Technology has certainly shaped beauty. Smartphones, artificial intelligence, and the metaverse are changing how we present ourselves on and offline. But how has beauty shaped technology? Hi, I'm Isabella Rossellini. In the latest episode of This Is Not a Beauty podcast, we'll hear from a Meta executive, a Paralympian, and more. Listen now on your favorite podcast platform.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, our populist president is proposing a tax plan that our reporter calls, quote, a wish list for billionaires. What we learn about this administration from the taxes it would cut. And three moments from a big week, hardline conservatives revive the same health care bill that they killed. The Supreme Court justices get heated, and a Facebook executive is surprised by the power of Facebook. It's Friday, April 28th. Why are you considered a tax expert?
You know, that's a really excellent question. I sort of feel like that's a question I get from people I interview all the time.
Yeah.
I've basically been writing about tax issues since 2006, so that's 11 years, believe it or not.
Well, when I emailed
I know some things.
When I emailed the right people last night to ask them who to talk to, they said, easy, Drucker.
Nice, good. But they didn't provide a first name, so maybe it was this other guy.
Nope, not another guy. Jesse Drucker is a business reporter at the Times. Jesse, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
What was your first reaction to this tax plan when you saw it?
It seemed like a wish list for billionaires. I mean, it is targeted tax relief.
We are going to cut taxes and simplify the tax code by taking the current seven tax brackets we have today and reducing them to only three brackets.
But it's targeted on really the wealthiest members of society.
Under the Trump plan, we will have a massive tax cut for businesses and massive tax reform and simplification.
Including, clearly, the president, based on what we know of his tax return.
Yes. Exactly a year ago, then-candidate Trump was asked if he believes in raising taxes on the wealthy. He said, I do, including myself, I do. So my question is, why isn't he doing that? And will the president end up paying more or less taxes as a result of this plan?
Well, let me just comment. I can't comment on the president's tax situation since I don't have access to that. Okay.
I'm going to ask the single simplest question possible about this subject, which is, what are federal taxes actually for?
Well, they're to keep the government running. For the most part, our federal taxes are going to pay for things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. They also pay for the military. They pay for interest on our debt. They pay to build highways and repair highways. But for the most part, most of what our taxes are going to fund is to basically keep elderly people out of poverty through the Social Security system.
So when you cut federal taxes, what generally happens?
Well, what generally happens is that you have this pool of money. Most of it is mandatory spending, and about 30% of it is discretionary spending. And so when you cut taxes, if you don't want to run deficits, then you have to cut your spending. And generally, that comes out of the so-called discretionary spending, which means spending on kind of everything else other than
things you don't have to do that are up to you, that are up to us as a country.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, we don't have to do any of it. In theory, we don't have to keep senior citizens out of poverty, and we don't have to pay for their health care. So in theory, you don't have to do any of it. But so it tends to come out of things that keep younger people out of poverty, or that repair bridges and highways, or keep our drinking water safe, or prevent workers from getting their arms ripped off when they work in factories, et cetera. There's basically a minority of the spending is what is generally subject to the cuts when we're trying to do things to pay for tax cuts.
When's the last time that the United States cut taxes as dramatically as President Trump is now proposing?
The last time we had a big holistic overhaul of the tax system was in the Tax Reform Act of 1986.
In a moment, I'll be sitting at that desk taking up a pen and signing the most sweeping overhaul of tax code in our nation's history.
Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill,
Speaker of the House,
the Democratic Speaker of the House at that time, got together and figured out a very comprehensive overhaul of our federal tax system.
When I sign this bill into law, America will have the lowest marginal tax rates and the most modern tax code among major industrialized nations.
Jesse, in short, what did the Reagan tax cuts in 1986 do?
Well, overall taxes on most families were reduced. There were some significant tax increases as well. And there was an effort to simplify the tax system. I think it would be a mistake to think that there was really simplification of the system. It was still kind of the same mess that it is now, but there that was one of the goals. But I think overall, certainly taxes on most families were reduced as a result of that, of the 86 Reform Act.
What happened to the United States economy after the Reagan tax cuts went into effect in 1986-87?
We see the acceleration of a trend that had already begun a few years earlier of basically stagnating income for the vast majority of Americans and accelerating income growth for a very small percent of people at the top. And that's a trend that has continued pretty much uninterrupted to this day, with the exception of about 5 years in the 1990s.
I feel like we've just played the World Series of tax reform. And the American people won.
So what's the difference between that plan we're discussing from the 1980s and what President Trump is proposing right now?
Well, what President Trump is proposing right now is basically a kind of across-the-board package of tax cuts. There's not really – it's not part of a plan to close loopholes or make the system fairer unless you just think cutting taxes for everyone is making it a fairer system.
So is what you're saying that the Trump tax plan is likely to intensify this trend you started describing – about income inequality growing?
I mean, one thing that is very interesting in the proposal, to the degree that we can call it a proposal, is he is introducing a whole new category of lower taxes on what we call pass-through income. And without getting too technical, most real estate developers, private equity managers, they organize their businesses as partnerships where the company does not pay any taxes. Mm-hmm. All of the tax obligations flow through to the people who work there, to the partners. If all you cared about was your taxes, then what you would do, Michael Barbaro, is you would quit your job at the New York Times today. You would become some kind of independent contractor, set up a partnership, enter into some kind of contracting arrangement with the Times. And then instead of paying taxes at whatever rate you pay, you would pay only at a rate of 15%. You also wouldn't have to worry about, I think, contributing to Social Security anymore. If this actually became law, you can expect that savvy people will do this. They will no longer be employees. They will figure out ways to organize their businesses as pass-throughs and pay this historically low rate of tax.
Just how low?
Oh, 15%.
And put that into some sort of perspective.
Well, 15... so currently the highest rate on regular income is technically right around 43%. Mm-hmm. So essentially people that are currently paying taxes at a rate of 42-43% would have the opportunity to reorganize their affairs and pay taxes at a rate of 15%. Mm-hmm. We were talking about something that would almost certainly exacerbate inequality and the trends that we've been seeing for decades.
Okay. I want to talk about what the Trump tax plan will mean for the national debt. One of the big concerns about this plan so far is that it could balloon national debt. And debt sounds bad on its face, but you know this well because you've covered him for a long time. Donald Trump has called himself the king of debt.
Hillary Clinton called you the king of debt.
Well, no, she didn't call me. I call myself the king of debt. I'm the king of debt. I'm great with debt. Nobody knows debt better than me. I've made a fortune by using debt.
Is there a case to be made for growing our debt, that it's not such a big deal?
If you have other goals, like you are running a deficit because you want to do government spending to do something that you think will stimulate the economy, like let's take on a bunch of debt because we want to pay for college for every 18-year-old in America for 2 years because we think that's an investment in our future, or repair every highway in America. I mean, I think that there is there's a school of economic thought that deficit spending can be good as a way to stimulate the economy. That does not – I'm pretty sure that is not part of this plan. I don't think that we are creating a deficit in pursuit of something other than to cut people's taxes.
And – is there a big difference between corporate debt, which is how Donald Trump financed a lot of his business, and, you know, government debt, which is what we're worried this tax plan might create?
Well, I mean, one difference is that the U.S. is unlikely to reduce its debt obligations by filing for bankruptcy, which is one of the ways that Donald Trump has dealt with his debts over the years.
And if things don't work out, I renegotiate the debt. I mean, that's a smart thing, not a stupid thing.
I mean, that's the most obvious difference. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump thinks of debts as things that can be negotiated and eliminated when they get out of hand.
Not so
true.
That
is generally not the way that the U.S. has approached it.
Who benefits most from this Trump tax proposal?
Very wealthy people. In some cases, only affect very wealthy people.
I mean, such as?
Well, so he is proposing to abolish the estate tax, which currently for a married couple only kicks in when you have an estate to leave to your heirs of $11 million or more. So by its very nature, that is a tax that is only affecting multimillionaires. You know, Donald Trump is a multi-billionaire. And if we were to assume that he were to leave an estate in the neighborhood of $3 billion to his heirs instead of paying taxes at a rate of roughly 50%, he would pay no estate taxes at all.
So that would allow Ivanka and Don Jr. and Eric Trump and the other heirs to collect a full $3 billion versus $1.5.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like I know the answer to this, but from our quote-unquote populist president, is this a populist tax plan?
I think it's pretty difficult to characterize this as a populist tax plan.
Jesse, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for The New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Three short scenes from the week. The first was in Congress, where the Republican health care bill is making a surprise reappearance.
I'm convinced we have made a bill better because of our engagement, because we held out on this bill. And I'm also convinced that if states get this waiver, premiums will come down for those families who happen to be in those states. So I think this is the best we're going to get right now in the House.
Hello?
Jennifer.
Hi.
It's Michael.
Hello.
Jennifer Steinhauer covers Congress. Jennifer, why are the people who brought down the Republican health care plan suddenly embracing it?
They got the folks on board by making the bill more conservative.
Hmm.
The president, who was extremely eager to have some type of repeal bill for Obamacare passed, preferably before his 100th day in office, pressured the House to go back to the table and try to figure out a way to get something done. The route that they chose was to try to bring on board the most conservative members, the House Freedom Caucus, who felt blamed for the failure of the bill, and to move the bill to the right, essentially giving states the option to provide essential health benefits to recipients in their state. And that was enough to get a lot of the conservatives. We don't know quite how many yet, but a great number of them are now yeses. How many folks remain or are becoming no as a result of that is something that we're going to find out. Obviously, no Democrats are going to vote for it. So the bill still is basically a political document at this point.
What has changed about the bill exactly to make it more tolerable to the Freedom Caucus?
What's essentially changed is they have made it possible for states to have more options to provide less care, to not force insurance companies to cover folks with pre-existing conditions, to let states have the option to not force insurers to have essential health benefits, which is a category of benefits like maternity and other preventative cares and cancer screenings and so forth that are part of the Obamacare legislation. They're pretty popular part.
Why would any lawmaker, conservative or not conservative, want to create options for insurers to provide less coverage? It seems counterintuitive.
Right. Well, many Republicans believe that that would be more cost effective because it's obviously expensive to cover people with pre-existing conditions, expensive to cover sick people, and they want to give states options. They want to provide health insurance. They want people to have, as they say, access to coverage. But the principal goal is to bend the cost curve. It's not to have universal or near universal or broad-based coverage.
I feel like this Republican healthcare plan has been torn apart. I mean, most Americans, because of the government analysis of it, see it as a plan that would very likely kick tens of millions of people off of their health care. Why are Republicans even trying to salvage it at this point? Why not just start all over?
I would answer that question in three ways. Question one, why did they even start with this? With a new president who was a real novice, to say the least, at dealing with Washington. That's a big question. Why didn't it start with taxes or infrastructure? Okay, but they did it. The effort failed, and it failed miserably and embarrassingly. So you ask, why do they pick it back up? Well, because the president asked them to. Paul Ryan, the day after the health care bill failed to get votes to bring to the floor, said Obamacare is law of the land.
Right, it's over.
It kind of colored it gone.
Move on.
Mitch McConnell said we're moving on. So then, like a zombie from the policy grave, this bill popped back up at the request of the president, who was basically miffed, Michael. He knew that many members had been running for years on repealing Obamacare. He talked about it during the campaign. He wasn't going to let it go. Even though he'd kind of engaged at the end of the process and was not in the weeds on the details, he wanted it done. So that's why they started to do it again. If they fail again, I will answer a question you didn't ask me, but that would be what's next. There is potential to fix problems, at least with the exchanges in Obamacare on a bipartisan basis in the Senate. That's possible. Is that possible over the House? That's kind of doubtful, but that could be a next step.
And when do you expect the vote to be?
If I had to guess, I would think the vote would be next week, if they get the votes. I don't think they'll bring it to the floor if they don't have the votes. That would probably be an embarrassment they could live without. But at this point, you could say this has been a mess, basically.
Jennifer, thank you very much. We will check back in with you next week to see if this moves ahead or if it goes back to the grave or if it zombies up again. We'll figure it out.
I greatly look forward to it.
Okay. Bye, Jennifer.
Bye.
The second scene was in the Supreme Court. Adam Liptak was there. Tell me about this case you watched in the Supreme Court yesterday.
So this was the court's last argument of the term. You might think it's a technical question about immigration law, but it turned into something really extraordinary. The justices got very upset with a government lawyer who took a completely hard line on when someone's U.S. citizenship can be withdrawn, revoked, stripped of citizenship, if they lied in any way in the process of obtaining their citizenship, however trivial the lie.
Any lie whatsoever.
Including a significant omission. So the Chief Justice says, well, you have to fill out this form that says, please discuss any criminal offense, however minor, whether you were arrested or not. And the Chief Justice says, well, I'm going to make a confession. I drove 60 miles an hour in a 55-mile-an-hour zone, and I got away with it.
Wow.
Are you telling me, he says to the government lawyer, that if I fail to disclose that, you can show up at my house and revoke my citizenship 20 years after I was naturalized? And the government lawyer amazingly said, yes, to which the Chief Justice uttered the immortal words, oh, come on.
That does not sound like Chief Justice Roberts.
He was hot, but not as hot as Justice Kennedy got, who really laid into this lawyer and said he was demeaning the priceless value of American citizenship. And then other justices piled on. Justice Sotomayor said, what if I fail to disclose a childhood nickname? Because you have to disclose your nicknames. Yep, we can strip you of citizenship for that. Justice Kagan says, well, I've lied about my weight, I'm horrified to say.
Jeez.
Same thing, same thing.
Is this an unusual tenor for the Supreme Court? It seems that way.
Yes. It was probably the liveliest and the most colorful argument of a fairly dull term.
And what do we learn from this case?
We learn that even Supreme Court justices who are logicians and technicians do have a human sense of common sense and fairness. And there are some things they just find appalling.
And what do we expect based on pretty openly hostile questioning from the justices is going to happen in this case?
I think the citizen whose citizenship was revoked is likely to get another shot to prove that the supposed lie that she was convicted of was immaterial. That was the question in the case, whether even immaterial lies will get you stripped of your citizenship. She wasn't a particularly sympathetic plaintiff. She might have lied about something important, but she was tried under this theory that it doesn't matter if your lie is big or small, any lie will do, and we can take away your citizenship.
Finally, what are we to make of this government lawyer who came in for some pretty stinging critiques from the Supreme Court?
I think I'm prepared to stick up for the guy. This was the position staked out by the federal government, both under Obama and Trump. You can ask questions about whether they couldn't have found some way to distinguish the case they were pressing from this general theory. But this was this theory in their briefs, and they sent in this guy to take the heat, and boy, did he.
Adam, thank you very much.
You bet.
Bye.
Bye.
The third scene was here at the Times. 2 years ago, many of us remember an unexpectedly raw post on Facebook by the chief operating officer of Facebook, Sheryl Sandberg.
I lost my husband, Dave, 2 years ago, and it's the unimaginable. I found him. We were on vacation celebrating a friend's 50th birthday party in a gym. I flew home to tell a 7- and a 10-year-old, my children, that they'd never see their father again. And, you know, the grief that followed was something I'd really never been prepared for. It felt like there was a void closing in on me. My brother-in-law talked about it as a boot pushing on his chest. It felt like every day, every week was a month, was a year. And it wasn't just the grief, it was the isolation. You know, before Dave died, I dropped my kids off at school. People said hi. I walk into the office. Everyone chit-chats, but not so much because I think people were so afraid to say the wrong thing. They most likely didn't say anything. And so I was just feeling worse and worse and worse. The Jewish period of mourning for a spouse is called Shloshim. It's 30 days from burial. And so I'd been keeping a journal. And as that day approached, I wrote a Facebook post, which is what I would say to everyone if I were going to say something. And the night before I went to bed thinking there is zero chance I'm posting this. It is just crazy open. And I woke up the next day and it was so awful. I thought, this is supposed to be the end of mourning. I couldn't feel worse. Things can't get worse, so maybe they'll get better. And I hit post. And, you know, it didn't take away the grief at all, but it did help with the isolation because it just broke open the conversation and kicked the elephant out of the room. My friend from work told me she'd been driving by my house for a month but hadn't come in. She started coming in. A woman from the NICU, a stranger, posted that she had just lost one twin and was trying to give the surviving twin a great life. And another woman who had lost a twin posted to her. And it was, for me, remembering, okay, I'm facing this horrible tragedy, but I am not alone. So many other people face adversity of all kinds. And when we talk about it, we can help each other get through it.
Sandberg's book about that experience was published this week, and she came to the Times to talk to Pamela Paul, editor of the Book Review and host of the Book Review podcast.
I didn't get most of this right before. You know, I used to think if someone was going through something hard, cancer, job loss, a death, the first time I saw them, I would say I was sorry, but then I wouldn't bring it up again because it was up to them to bring it up. And if I brought it up, I would be reminding them. That's absurd. You can't remind me Dave died. I know Dave died. I know Dave died every day, all the time. So when people didn't say anything, it felt like they weren't acknowledging the pain. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you on Monday.